this all had not resolved the issue between father and son, for a curious and painful fact now became transparent. Fulfilling his father's stated goals did not bring parental approval. His father's discontent seemed to increase in direct proportion to his son's accomplishment. Now Mozart could no longer ignore the likelihood that an unspoken grievance against him was that he had surpassed his father's expectations. And if that were so, then he could never hope to obtain his father's approval or forgiveness, or even to demonstrate retroactively that he had been in the right. Thus he was involved in a contest from which he could never emerge victorious. He could neither be loved for his person nor praised for his achievements. His only hope was to settle the score. Unwinnable contests evoke desperate remedies. In the present contest, Mozart proved to be the more subtle and even the more deadly antagonist. That he worked assiduously to bring his father's resentments to the surface is quite clear. Mozart put on a demonstration of his success, affluence, and musical achievement sufficient to arouse the envy even of Saint Cecilia, patron saint of music. Heedless of his father's advanced age and weakened physical condition, he arranged for his presence at every concert and festivity. It was as though he had staged this triumphant panorama, this Mozart carnival, for the purpose of finally putting his father's reproaches to rest, and, let it be said plainly, of demonstrating his own superiority and vitality at the expense of a lonely old widower. And so at the end of Leopold's life, we find him combating his isolation, his widowerhood, his embitterment, his physical decline, and the disintegration of his status by a variety of effective strategies. Leopold continued to do business, selling keyboard instruments and books, lending money, negotiating with dealers to dispose of jewelry and other valuable objects on behalf of his son-in-law, the husband of his daughter, Marianne. Leopold Mozart had never revealed to Mozart the extent of the profits from the grand journey and the Italian journeys. That was when Mozart was 13 and 14. On the contrary, in letters from 1778 onward, he always gave the clear impression that the family's economic condition was a precarious one and that he had gone into debt in order to promote his son's interests. Of course, Mozart surely suspected otherwise. He was not blind to the evidence of his father's multiple business activities, fine apartments and servants, nor, I should say, of his renown as a teacher of violin and the author of a remarkable thesis on violin playing, which became very famous at the time. Nor was the effective disinheritance, save only for a portion of the value of personal effects, something that should have surprised him. We need only recall when he married, he had been bluntly warned not to expect anything from his father. Now, however, reading his father's will, he experienced with full force the shock of being excluded from his share of funds that were largely the result of his own talents and labor. As though contemplating what would happen when his father died, Mozart seems to have tried to convert his imagined future anger into comedy and his grief into cynicism. At the time of Leopold's final illness, in the spring of 1787, Mozart sketched the scenario of a farce in which a father is ridiculed for his parsimony. And after Leopold died in 1787, at the age of 68, one of Wolfgang's first compositions was the highly satiric piece called The Village Musicians, better known to us as A Musical Joke. Alfred Einstein, the cousin of physicist Albert, the leading musicologist and Mozart biographer, wrote that shortly after a musical joke, Wolfgang decided to set the world aright again with Eine kleine Nachtmusik. One of the pieces of correspondence from Leopold to his son warns him against the proposed journey to England. Had he gone, like his friend and mentor Haydn before him, it is quite possible that he might have found satisfactory employment there, and that he might have survived years later in the nearly 36 that marked his earthly days. Near the end of that roses and thorns relationship of father and son Mozart, there came another strange irony. The composer's sister, Marianne, or Nannerl, as the family called her, gave birth to a son named Leopold after his grandfather. Astonishingly, the grandfather took the little boy into his own household, virtually adopting him. But he didn't tell Wolfgang about that, a fact that was revealed to him later by gossip. Why all that? Maynard Solomon explains. Leopold Mozart didn't want his son to know that he intended to mold a tiny piece of flesh into a new and malleable object, one through which he could again find fulfillment and glory. And he knew that Wolfgang would have regarded it as the latest and perhaps most extreme instance of a familiar, coercive paternalism. It might have been recognized as an old man's desperate strategy to extend his life by setting himself a task, the raising and education of a child that would take many years to complete. It was clear to the enlightened deputy Kapellmeister of Salzburg that he had once again been called upon to transform a poor inch of nature into a miraculous child, whose wonders would in due course be revealed to an amazed mankind. Once again, Leopold Mozart had made his calculations. Unfortunately, there was not enough time for God to ratify them. Unquote. And this is why we must leave the sad and edifying tale of father and son Mozart with the valued help of what we might call the wisdom of Solomon. In this case, Dr. Maynard Solomon. The question remains, would this young and highly gifted composer have become the master we know had he not labored under such personal pressure all his life long? Would his genius have flourished in the ambience of a more positive family relationship? Did he need that degree of outside control to do his finest work? Would a wiser guardianship have directed him toward different paths? Was suffering and deprivation necessary for deepening and intensifying his art? We may speculate, but we shall never really know. There are, it is said, no conditionals in history. In any case, we may find reassurance in the awareness that the son whom Leopold brought up and nearly brought down turned out to be, in spite of, or because of it all, Wolfgang Amadei Mozart, the composer of at least 626 extraordinary pieces of music, and probably hundreds more not officially numbered. It is a legacy equaled or approached by few others in the long history of music. We may now take a much-needed and well-deserved 10-minute break, after we shall have the joy of hearing several more masterpieces from the vast literature of keyboard music given to us so generously by this incomparable musical genius. See you a little later. second 50-minute hour. Actually, it'll be a good deal less than that. Don't worry. Mozart claimed in a letter that he was no poet, but he was only half right. Although his spelling was extremely sloppy, he had a remarkable literary gift, writing some 1,000 brilliant and perceptive letters, and even participating in Lorenzo da Ponte's libretti for his operas. He was, in addition, master of at least 4 languages, German, French, Italian, and Latin. And how witty a writer of verse he really could be, we can see from a wedding poem that he sent to his sister in 1784. In translating it, I tried to retain his rhyme scheme after the short introduction. He wrote to her, and he says, "And now I send you 1,000 good wishes from Vienna to Salzburg, especially that you both may live together as well as we two. Therefore, take from my poetical skull or brain box a little advice. Hear it now. Much will you learn in matrimony that somewhat puzzled you before. Soon will you know from real life how Eve had to perform as wife, so that soon after Cain she bore. But sister, duties conjugal, you gladly will discharge withal, for trust me, they're not hard at all. Yet every matter has 2 sides. While the estate will bring delights, some sorrows go along with it. You'll see your husband fiercely glower, which you believe you don't deserve, while he is in a mood right sour. So chalk it up to male caprice and say, 'O Lord, your will be done in daytime, and mine comes the night.'" Now, this surely is no childish lout writing as in Peter Schoeffer's Amadeus. This is a highly erotic, sensual, and experienced young man of surpassing intelligence. When we hear his later operas, we also begin to see how he was much more than a musicus, a musician. His musical characterizations were so brilliantly perceptive that we could call him an instinctive psychologist of human nature. In the book just published, Michael Steinberg wrote, "It's wonderful at this messy moment in the world's history to find someone who can speak to us about everything. Bathroom humor, a misplaced pin, the sadness of lost love, and the awesome and incalculable powers of Eros, Thanatos, and forgiveness." You will next hear the Rondo in A minor by Mozart. In our attempt to showcase him as a composer of highly serious and personally expressive music, rather than as the producer of high-class entertainment that the public demanded of him, we can't do better than to offer you this late composition from 1887, 3.5 years before Mozart's death, only a year before the last great symphonies. You notice that 4 of the 5 works of the program are in the minor mode. They're not minor works. They are major works of their kind. The quiet and intimate nature of this rondo in A minor is akin to that wonderful F sharp minor slow movement in the piano concerto K488, which those of us who are musicians are so fond of, and which is also the finale of it, is the theme in Eric Kish's Musical Passions program on WCLV. You hear that every Sunday at 11. Here in this rondo is that restless chromaticism. Let's not forget that the Greek word chroma means color. This isn't music that one can describe at all, just as you cannot really describe a color. The subtlety and grace of its progressions surpasses most other music in that style. There is a middle section in A major which seems to promise some emotional relief, but it soon becomes clear that hardly any tension has been abandoned. When the opening music returns, it undergoes notable intensification, and the close leaves us with a strange and fatalistic pianissimo. Here again is Michael Schneider. very likely that this piece began as an improvisation. It was then written down and refined. There are certain passages there that show you that Mozart was fantasizing, as they called it. This happens in many cases. It is really also the history of the cadenza in piano concertos. It usually began as an improvisation that was then refined and written down and used again for later performances, each time perhaps a little differently. Now, Mozart and his older friend and mentor Haydn defined, refined, and perfected the musical language of their time. Sigmund Freud was much more the revolutionary, thrusting into areas that had not been explored so perceptively since Shakespeare did so in his plays. So for much too long a time, some writers on music have wanted us to believe that music after Bach and Handel culminated in the work of Beethoven. That is one of those historical fallacies we should no longer accept as gospel when we come across it. Mozart and Haydn were no forerunners to anybody. What they achieved was the apex of the classical style, music that could not be bettered, but only succeeded. And no one knew this better than Beethoven himself, who learned all he could from Haydn and Mozart, and then realized that he had to do something different, something of his own, go in a direction only hinted at before. That some music by the two older masters looked forward to the so-called romantic era of the 19th century cannot be denied. But the vast expansion of the musical medium and the growing attention to music with a story or a program was indeed a sign of the times in the era of Napoleon and the new century. Yet the elements we consider today so characteristic of Beethoven can already be found in Mozart and Haydn, the peremptory, the grandiose, even the heroic. The younger man, Beethoven, just 21 when Mozart died, was well acquainted with his later works, including Don Giovanni and the Magic Flute and the Last Symphonies, as well, of course, of Haydn's last 12 symphonies and so impressive a work as The Creation. So it is almost certain that he knew the C minor sonata of 1784 and had played it through. And here he encountered music of conciseness, compression, direct and unswerving purpose. C minor was for him, as for Mozart, a tonality of pathos, of agitation, of high drama. And the events of the first movement here include all those elements, a thrust into the future like few others. Think of the C minor piano concerto of Mozart and the C minor piano concerto of Beethoven, number 3. The C minor sonata was composed, as I said, in October of 1784, but in May of the next year, Mozart wrote a C minor fantasia, the same key, which he meant to precede the sonatas, dedicating the two-part work to one of his best pupils. And that fantasia is regarded as one of the supreme examples of Mozart's improvisatory style, and is even more indicative of what Beethoven was to do beginning a decade later. Time doesn't permit us to hear that remarkable fantasia, but it's been beautifully recorded by Ashkenazi and others. The slow movement Adagio is a big composition in rondo design, and the lavish ornamentation is always a part, an integral part of the music, never an example of virtuosity display for its own sake. In the finale, another rondo in which the main theme comes round and round again, that's why it's called a rondo, is full of nervous energy with an unstable syncopated rhythm setting the scene. The development section with its sharp dynamic contrasts is also music which the young Beethoven would have been proud to have written. Dramatic pauses break the forward motion, a melodic fragment calls again for crossing of the hands right over left, and the close is as hard and unforgiving as towering rocks and boulders on the shores of Maine or Oregon. Of the ingratiating porcelain figure of Mozart on top of the piano, there is not a trace. Michael Schneider will now play this extraordinary piece for you, Mozart at his most dramatic and utterly serious.
Thank you. Thank you.
is one of those pieces which the word wow is most applicable. Must have been stunning to the audiences of the time. The Emperor Joseph II, who was a great admirer of Mozart's, as you have heard, once said to him, my dear Mozart, your music is rather too highly spiced for us Viennese. This piece must have absolutely stunned them. And now to send you off with a bit of good cheer after all this serious stuff, here is a little piece by Mozart that you may have heard years ago, played by Arthur Lesser, who loved its impish wit. It was supposed to be an encore, but so for you, for the record, I put it in the program itself. You can regard it as an encore, but you'll need to remember what it was by having it written down. The Little Gigue was composed by Mozart on his visit to Leipzig on May 16, 1789. It was notated into the personal album of the Saxon court organist Engel as, quote, a memento of true and genuine friendship and brotherly love. And it is signed by the composer as Kapellmeister of His Imperial and Royal Majesty, who was at that time Joseph II. Leipzig, of course, was the city where Mozart had most directly encountered and experienced the music of J.S. Bach, from studying his scores in libraries and even in actual performances. He is reported to have observed, aha, here is someone we can really learn from. So the Little Gigue pays tribute to the contrapuntal wizardry of Bach, some of his French or English suites, without actually copying or imitating him. Short as it is, the piece is something of a harmonic labyrinth with all kinds of polyphonic tricks of the three interlocking voices. And after the active texture of the piece, which wears its learning lightly, the unison ending is all the more effective and emphatic. Here again is Michael Schneider with Mozart's Little Gigue as an entertaining encore to bring this evening to a reassuringly positive close. You have been a wonderful audience. Let the music have the last word. something. The other tape.